On April 15th, airplanes from U.S. territory attacked three important targets on the island: San Antonio de los Baños, Ciudad Libertad, and Eastern Santiago de Cuba. On April 16th, the day of the burial of the victims of the airstrike, then-President Fidel Castro met with the Cuban people and declared the socialist character of the revolution. Up next, Bernie Dwyer reports on the days prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Que los que no pueden perdonarnos los imperialistas es que estemos aquí. Los que no pueden perdonarnos los imperialistas es la dignidad, la entereza, el valor, la firmeza ideológica, el espíritu de sacrificio y el espíritu revolucionario. Eso es lo que no pueden perdonarnos, que estemos ahí en sus narices y que hayamos hecho una revolución socialista en las propias narices de los Estados Unidos.
That was the voice of the young Fidel Castro declaring the socialist nature of the Cuban Revolution in no uncertain terms. It is obvious by the reaction of the Cuban people present that this was a popular move. However, the U.S.-backed Cuban mercenaries who had fled Cuba after the triumph of the revolution in 1959 were paying no heed to the voices of the people. The following day, they were to invade Cuba, foolishly believing that they would gain the support of the Cuban people. Documents released by the CIA show that the CIA officials believed that the Cuban people would welcome a U.S.-sponsored invasion and spontaneously rise up against the revolutionary government. CIA officials also expected that Cuban military and police forces would refuse to fight against Brigade 2506, the CIA's 1,400-man mercenary invasion forces. Arnie Coro, who you will be familiar with through listening to his program, The Xers, was one of those who did fight against them. I asked Arnie what was his first knowledge of the impending Bay of Pigs invasion.
Well, actually, we were installing Radio Havana Cuba transmitters, our first transmitters, in the little town of Bauta, which is west of the city of Havana, about some 20 miles to the west of the city. And we started to learn that something was going on when the station was equipped with anti-aircraft guns. You know, we say, well, something is going to happen because, you know, this is normal. And also, we started to monitor some of the shortwave broadcasts that were coming from the United States and from Swan Island, a station that the CIA had set up there called Radio Swan, which was a covert operation. And we realized that something was going on because the propaganda coming from that station was in crescendo. It was, you know, more and more violent at every time. But the real day that we really knew what was happening, I was on leave of absence, and I had a 48-hour leave from my military duty, and I went home. This was on the 15th of April of 1961. And we lived very near one of the airports that were bombed by the B-26 planes that came from Nicaragua. And it was very early in the morning, and we wake up at my home, my brother, my father, and myself, with the three men of the house. We heard the explosions, and then I went out to the yard, and I saw a B-26 plane climbing after doing a strafing run. And I said, well, they're bombing the airport. So everybody ran and took positions after that, on the 16th of April. And then I remember they said that we had to go to 12th and 23rd Street, where everybody will be gathering for the burial ceremony of those who had died during the attack to the airports. And there we went, and from there we went back to our military unit, which was the western side of the city of Havana. And on the 17th, very early in the morning, through our radios, we learned that the invasion was in progress. And actually, my small part of my unit went to the theater of operations in Hawaii Grande, you know, where the command post was, on the 18th in the afternoon. So I really saw about a day of actual operations. But what my unit had to do, and was very interesting, was picking up all these mercenaries from the Zapata swamp.
I asked Don Ikoro about picking up the mercenaries in the swamp. What kind of guys were they?
I think there are two things I want to make clear. I saw at least one dead American there, a pilot of a B-26 aircraft, and I saw the documents of this pilot. He came from the Alabama Air National Guard. I think he was recruited to do some complicated flying that the Cuban mercenaries were not able to do, or there were not enough mercenaries that knew how to fly the B-26s. And also, it was, something very moving, because I saw some of my schoolmates on the other side. You know, I went to a Jesuit school, the Colegio de Belén in Havana, which was a school for middle-class and upper-middle-class persons, and many of my classmates went to Miami as soon as the revolution started. You know, they were absolutely scared, anti-communists, and this and this and that, and they just flew away. And they were recruited by the CIA, and they became part of the 2506 Brigade, and they came as mercenaries, you know. I remember Mayito Muxo, who was killed in action, he came in a parachute, you know, landing by parachute. I saw also Carlos Varona, which was in school with me. He was the son of a prominent politician of the Cuban Banana Republic before the revolution. And this was something, you know, when seeing those people, well, we treat them very well. We were, of course, providing them every guarantee. No one was killed. Everybody was sent into prison. They were given everything that they needed.
Those who organized the invasion got it so wrong. The first paragraph of Michael Warner's book, Lessons Unlearned, the CIA's internal probe of the Bay of Pigs affair, reflects the dismay of all concerned in the debacle.
The Bay of Pigs invasion met its ignominious end on the afternoon of 19 April 1961, 3 days after the force of Cuban emigres had landed on the beach. The CIA officers who planned the assault gathered around a radio in their Washington War Room while the Cuban brigade's commander transmitted his last signal. He had been pleading all day for supplies and air cover, but nothing could be done for him and his men. Now he could see Fidel Castro's tanks approaching. "I have nothing left to fight with," he shouted. "I'm taken to the woods. I can't wait for you." Then the radio went dead, leaving the drained and horrified CIA men holding back nothing.
Thanks to Kotopupu, our sound engineer. This is Bernie Dwyer in Havana.
In the second part of our special programs to commemorate Cuba's victory of the U.S. invasion of Playa Quirón on April 19th, Bernie Dwyer talks to Bay of Pigs veteran Arnie Coro, who was only 19 when he took part in a military operation. In our upcoming program, Arnie goes into detail about how the invasion was defeated and how the United States administration got it so wrong.
I read a book by an American author named Peter Wyden, who explained a lot about how this invasion of Cuba was prepared. And this Bay of Pigs fiasco, which was the best description of it, was caused by a summing up of many, many misperceptions on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency of the U.S. government, of the Pentagon, of State Department. Many agencies were involved, you know. You cannot, for example, they wanted an Air Force, and they realized that if they used jet aircraft, it would be very clear that the aircraft were part of the U.S. Air Force, you know. So they decided that they would be using propeller-type bombers. And the only place where they could find those bombers, those Second World War bombers, Second World War vintage bombers, B-26s, is a medium bomber, the only place they could find it was at the Alabama National Guard. And of course, there they found the pilots too. So the CIA contacted the Alabama National Guard and gave them the order to proceed to provide the pilots and the aircraft. So this was a sort of very well orchestrated interagency operation. No one was innocent in this, you know. The Pentagon was knowledgeable about the existence of the airstrip in Nicaragua. They knew about the bombs, you know, where the ordnance came. It came from the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force arsenals, you know, where the weapons are kept. Because 250-pound bombs are not sold at a store in Miami, you know. Those things you have to buy from weapons exchange program that only, they are only sold to governments. And in this case, this was no government. One very interesting aspect of this was that they prepared a Cuban government in exile who was, this government was waiting in Miami so that when they were supposed to secure an airstrip in the Bay of Pigs area, a tourist resort that was under construction there, and if the airstrip was secured, this provisional Cuban government was supposed to be flown from Miami, from South Florida, to the Bay of Pigs, landed there, and then this provisional Cuban government, the planning was that it would ask for the U.S. government to provide help, and that will lead to the intervention of the U.S. armed forces. You know, so this invasion was organized in such a way that it was step one of a program that contemplated an actual second phase invasion of Cuba by the U.S. military, the professional U.S. military, no, not this mercenary. And this is something that must always be denounced, because people say those were Cuban patriots, you know, quote unquote, that were going to topple Fidel Castro's government and so on. I know, these were people that were recruited and paid for. Their families were receiving paychecks in Florida from the U.S. government coffers, you know, from the U.S. government treasury department. They were paying their families a certain amount of money every month. So they were participating in a U.S. military operation. They were not, definitely not, by any standards, they were voluntary people or anything of that sort. They joined this because they wanted to come to Cuba to recover their properties. And among those who came were several of the worst criminals of the Batista dictatorship, people that had killed many Cuban patriots during the period between 1952 and 1958, when the Batista government was in power here, under the protection and the sponsorship of the U.S. government. And I want to tell you something. When I was very young, I lived near one of the military airports where the Batista aircraft were parked and operated from. And I saw many bombs which were attached to the wings of those aircraft that had two shaking hands together, and they said, for mutual hemispheric defense use only. Okay? And those bombs were launched against the farmers, the peasants of the Sierra Maestra Mountain that were helping Fidel with the guerrilla warfare against the Batista government. So you can see that this has a long-standing history of intervention. And the aircraft were provided by the United States government under a program. There was even a military mission in Havana. I knew some of the sons and daughters of the U.S. military men that were here living permanently as part of the supplies that the U.S. government was giving to the Batista government, to the Batista dictatorship. And when Batista was thrown away by the revolution and the revolution came into power, immediately, like flipping a switch, the American government started plans to try to destroy the Cuban Revolution. But today, 47 years later, here we are standing and free.
Si esperan otra ocasión para el crimen repetir, si piensan en reincidir, remember Playa Girón.
Well, my perception is that Kennedy received this Bay of Pigs Operation Pluto from the Eisenhower administration as, like the French say, fait accompli. It was something that was already organized, everything was set in place. Remember, Kennedy took office at the third week of January of 1961, and the Bay of Pigs invasion happened on the 17th of April, so just a few weeks after he was in power. And they were exerting a tremendous pressure upon him to launch the invasion. They said everything is ready, all the people are in position, the aircraft have been flown from Alabama to Nicaragua, the ordnance is there, the bombs are there, and they used five cargo ships, civilian cargo ships, that were owned by some people that were very close to Batista. So you see, this was organized so that it will look like, will appear like a civilian group of people that had organized the invasion. So Bay of Pigs was a very complex, a really very complex military operation. It costed the U.S. taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars at that time. And you know, the value of the dollar 47 years ago was much more than today, and they never recovered from that. As a matter of fact, it was interesting to read many years later that they ran sort of a damage control after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, what we call the victory of Playa Girón, of course, and it was impossible for them to recover from that, because in 68 hours, the Cuban troops won this war. 68 hours it took.
You were listening there to Arnie Coro. Arnie Coro is Cuban, who was 19 years of age and was involved in the invasion of Playa Girón, fighting against the invading troops. He has a great memory, as you can hear, and I think it's terrific for us to hear the details of what actually went on, rather than read it on the history page, or the page of the history book, I should say. So we'll be hearing some more. Keep tuned to Radio Havana, Cuba. And in Havana, I'm Bernie Dwyer.
Today we give you the final program in our special series to commemorate the victory of the Cuban people over the invading mercenary forces sent by the United States 47 years ago. Bernie Dwyer continues her interview with Arnie Coro, who tells us about his experience as a young combatant against the invaders.
Si esperan otra ocasión para el crimen repetir, si piensan en reincidir, remember Playa Girón.
Están pensando en otra ocasión, remember Playa Girón.
Arnie, do you think that Fidel Castro and the Revolutionary Army were prepared for this invasion, that they knew about it, that they actually had intelligence that it was going to happen, when and where it was going to happen? Or do you think that Fidel Castro had the troops standing by and the Cubans themselves standing by since the triumph of the revolution?
My perception is that Fidel and the group of Cuban leaders in charge were very much aware that something was happening, that there were plans against Cuba. You know, the very existence of this radio station broadcasting this kind of aggressive propaganda. I remember we had a sort of a, like an ad, like a commercial, say, a Cuban worker who, you that know your machinery, destroy it so that the communists cannot use it, you know. So when you hear that kind of stuff coming into your country, you say, well, this is maybe phase one. Phase two will probably be a military invasion. So at the very end of 1959, beginning of 1960, Cuba started to prepare the militias, ask for people to join voluntarily, and hundreds of thousands of Cubans received military training. And there were deployed all over the Cuban archipelago. Cuba is not just the island of Cuba. We were very concerned about the island of youth, because we thought if an invading force takes the island of youth, they will bring in a provisional government and they will declare that island then is independent to Cuba, and that would be a big problem. So the Isle of Youth, there was a joke, okay? One person that lived there told me that the geographers were very concerned about the Isle of Youth. And I asked, why? And I said, because you, the militiamen, have put so much military equipment here that the island has gone down into the ocean about 2 inches. And it was true, you know, we put whatever we had there in order to make them aware that it would be very, very difficult to take over and invade the Isle of Youth. And also, all around Cuba, we established lookouts. People were always looking at the coastline to see what happened, if someone was coming. But also, my perception is that we didn't have that crystal clear intelligence telling us that the invasion would be coming the second week of, after the second week of April, and that it would be 1,500 people. You know, we had maybe some hearsay from someone saying, well, people are disappearing from Miami. And obviously, they were disappearing from Miami, they were going somewhere. But I don't think we have this kind of thing. So we did what perhaps was the best strategy. Be prepared for a possible invasion coming to do the actual landing anywhere. And you know something? Cuba has 5,000 kilometers of coastline. So watching them, just watching them, is quite a task. And the place they selected, they targeted for doing the landing operation, was very well selected because it was very isolated. It had one highway that would put the invading forces very fast into the central highway, just a couple of hours driving past. But the miscalculation was that they didn't expect the militia battalion from Cienfuegos to be deployed right there. That militia battalion from Cienfuegos, battalion number 339, really, really was able to hold them back until reinforcements came from the western part of the island and the central part of the island. And the world organized the command post at the Australia-Cuba Mill, and he said, this invasion must be destroyed as soon as possible, because he was very clearly thinking that if they were able to take a stronghold, then this provisional government thing will come flying from Miami. You know, the people of this provisional government selected by, very carefully handpicked by the CIA, you know, they were left sitting on their plane, a military C-47. They were so sure that they were going to do it, that they were taken to this small airport near Miami, and they were sitting on the plane just waiting for a radio signal to come from USA. Come and land. And the airstrip at Playa Girón was the place selected to do that. And, it was impossible for them to hold it, because more than 150 Cubans gave their lives in order to stop that invasion. And this is something that we must always remember. when you go from Central Australia, from the Australia sugar mill, to Playa Larga and Playa Girón, you will see all along the railroad, which has the swamp on both sides, the Zapata swamp, it's a very huge swamp, something like the Everglades in South Florida, same kind of swamp. You will see the small monuments at the places where the brave Cuban fighters died. At each monument is marked. And I remember a very good friend of mine that died there, Jose Antonio Diaz, he was on with the anti-aircraft artillery, and you will see the names of all of them all along the many, many miles of highway. So I think this is something that must always be remembered, that more than 150 brave Cubans gave their lives for our independence and to fight this invasion coming from the United States.
So, listeners, that's the end of our three-part series, our special program on the invasion of Playa Girón, the victory over the mercenary forces at the Bay of Pigs, 47 years ago this month. In Havana, I'm Bernie Dwyer.